So imagine someone hands you a business pitch, right, for your portfolio.
Okay, I'm listening.
And the core product this company produces is just universally loathed by, well, basically every ESG committee globally.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a tough sell right out of the gate.
Right, and it gets worse. The international community is actively trying to regulate it out of existence.
Naturally.
And then, perhaps most damning of all, the company's own domestic government has officially mandated the structural decline of this exact industry within the next 4 years.
Wow. So a universally hated, structurally declining business.
Exactly. So my question to you is, would you buy the stock?
Absolutely not. I mean, nobody touches that.
Well, what if I told you that exact stock is up roughly 50% in the last 12 months, and it's currently yielding nearly 8%?
Okay, see, that setup immediately forces you to confront this profound disconnect,
Yeah.
between the sort of macroeconomic narrative and the microeconomic reality.
Right, because the narrative says it's dead.
Yeah, you're looking at a classic distressed industry profile, right? But then the market is rewarding it
Yeah.
with the kind of capital appreciation you normally associate with, like a high-growth tech platform.
It's wild. And that is exactly what we're getting into today. Welcome to the deep dive, everyone.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, we are jumping into this really fascinating institutional research memo. It's dated today, actually, June 10th, 2026, and it breaks down the mechanics of China's Shenhua Energy Company Limited.
Or, for those of you tracking the unsponsored over-the-counter ADR, the ticker is CSUAY.
Yep, CSUAY. And we are talking about the undisputed heavyweight champion of the space here, the world's largest listed coal producer.
Operating right at the absolute foundation of the world's second largest economy.
Exactly. So, okay, let's unpack this. Because the central tension of this memo, and really the whole thesis we need to dissect today, is that the analyst writing this is looking at that 50% run-up and that massive yield.
Right, that 7.7% yield.
Yeah, and
Yeah.
they are flat out refusing to issue a buy rating.
Yeah, they've pegged Shenhua with a really cautious hold rating or accumulate on weakness, specifically targeting income investors rather than growth investors.
Which is so interesting, and the analyst uses this metaphor on page one that perfectly frames the entire dilemma. They describe China Shenhua as a fortress around a melting glacier.
I love that phrasing. It's so evocative.
It really is. So our overarching mission for this deep dive is to figure out exactly how thick the walls of that fortress are, calculate the melt rate of the glacier inside, and try to understand the valuation mechanics of a business caught in a massive, undeniable structural decline.
So to evaluate those walls, you really have to look past the primary product. I mean, the immediate mistake most market participants make when they look at Shenhua is valuing it as a pure-play mining operation.
Right, just looking at the coal.
Exactly. If you model their cash flows based solely on the volume of coal pulled out of the earth, multiplied by the spot market price of that coal, your model will break.
It just won't work.
No, because the underlying architecture of the business is entirely different.
So, wait, if I'm not just buying a coal miner, what exactly am I buying? Because the memo points out that in their fiscal year 2024, coal accounted for about 79% of their total revenue.
Right, which was a staggering 338.4 billion RMB.
Yeah. So on the surface, that looks exactly like a pure play commodity producer.
Well, yeah, but revenue composition masks the actual profit engine. You really have to look at how that coal physically moves from the mine to the end user.
Okay, follow the coal.
Exactly. Shenhua operates this interlocking, fully vertically integrated physical supply chain. The coal is extracted from their mines, sure, but then it immediately loads onto their own dedicated heavy haul railway lines.
Their own railways.
Yes, and those railways transport the coal directly to their own proprietary seaborne ports.
Oh, wow.
And from the ports, it's loaded onto their own captive shipping fleet. And ultimately, a significant portion of that coal never even enters the open market.
Where does it go then?
It is delivered directly to their own captive coal-fired power plants or coal chemical facilities to be burned or processed internally.
Wait, hold on. Owning an entire national scale transit network like railways, ports, shipping fleets, that sounds like a massive capital-intensive liability.
It can be.
Right. Because when commodity prices crash, as they always do, doesn't all that fixed infrastructure just become a giant financial weight around their neck?
Yeah.
I mean, you have to maintain 2,400 kilometers of track, whether the coal is selling for 1,000 RMB or 400 RMB.
Well, that's only true if that infrastructure is operating below capacity. But because they control the entirety of the volume moving through it, they ensure maximum utilization.
So the trains are always full.
Always. The logistics segments are effectively shielded from the commodity price volatility. Just look at the pre-tax profit breakdown in the memo.
Yeah, let me pull that up.
While coal might be 79% of the revenue, the logistics segment, so the railways, ports, and shipping, contributed around 18% of the pre-tax profit.
And the margins on those segments are completely divorced from mining economics.
Completely. The railway segment operates at a 37.1% gross margin.
That's crazy.
And the port segment operates at a 39.1% gross margin.
Okay, so wait. If I buy this stock, I'm actually buying a highly profitable toll road and a utility company, and it just happens to be wearing a coal miner's hard hat.
That is exactly what you are buying.
It honestly reminds me of the underlying genius of the Amazon delivery model.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
Yeah, imagine if Amazon didn't just sell you the retail product, but they literally owned the interstate highway system the truck drove on, right?
Right, right.
And they owned the Trans-Pacific cargo ships, and they never had to forfeit a single cent of margin to FedEx, UPS, or Maersk. They just capture the spread at every single physical touch point.
What's fascinating here is that Bruce Greenwald's framework for competitive advantages relies heavily on this exact dynamic.
Oh, yeah. How so?
Well, he argues that the most impenetrable economic moat a business can build is a structural cost advantage fused with captive economies of scale. Okay, break that down for Shenhua. So Shenhua bypasses the heavily congested, expensive national railway system in China entirely. They utilize 2,408 kilometers of their own dedicated heavy haul track.
That is a lot of track.
It's massive.
Yeah.
And that west-to-east physical corridor terminates at Huanghuo Port, which, by the way, has been the number one coal transfer port in China for six consecutive years.
Wow, 6 years.
Yeah. And think about the barrier to entry here. No private competitor, and honestly, not even a competing state-owned enterprise, can simply decide to replicate 2,400 kilometers of railway in modern China.
Right, you can't just buy land and start laying track.
Exactly. It requires decades of sovereign-level coordination, land rights, and eminent domain that only a central entity can execute.
Which is just impossible to replicate. And if you are managing your own portfolio, you know, this is the ultimate lesson in hunting for hidden margins.
Absolutely.
Sometimes the primary product the world associates with a company is really just the physical excuse to operate a monopolistic, highly profitable logistics network in the background. The coal is the payload, but the railway is the actual business.
Which brings us to the raw extraction economics. Because yes, the logistics network protects the downstream margins, but we really have to stress test the mining operations themselves.
Right. We need to know how deep that cost advantage goes.
And the financials reveal a cost structure that completely insulates them from industry downturns.
Let's look at that raw self-produced cash cost, like the absolute rock bottom price to physically pull a ton of coal out of the ground.
Yep.
The memo pegs Shenhua's cost at approximately 167 RMB per ton.
167, yeah.
Now, a number like that means nothing without industry context, obviously. So I looked it up, and the average mine mouth cost in China sits around 286 RMB per ton.
Right. And the marginal producers, you know, those smaller provincial mines operating at the fringes, they're dragging coal out of the ground at a cost of 450 to 550 RMB per ton.
That is an insane disparity. It's like they were playing a totally different sport.
The disparity there dictates the survival mechanics of the entire Chinese energy market.
Yeah.
I mean, we are looking at last man standing economics in its purest form.
How does that play out in a down market?
Well, in any commodity sector, the market clearing price is heavily influenced by the marginal cost of production. So the highest cost required to meet current demand.
Right.
When macroeconomic conditions weaken and the spot price of coal begins to crash, the producers with a 500 RMB cost basis immediately plunge into negative cash flow.
Because they're losing money on every ton.
Exactly. They are physically forced to halt operations or just go bankrupt.
So if the market price collapses to 400 RMB, the industry is experiencing an absolute bloodbath, but Shenhua is still generating a massive profit.
Oh, huge. The memo explicitly states that even at cycle low prices, Shenhua maintains a gross margin of roughly 47% on self-produced coal.
47% during a depression.
Right. They aren't just surviving the downturn. They are operating with software-like gross margins in a heavy industry depression.
That's just wild.
Furthermore, their balance sheet allows them to weather those cycles without external financing pressure. Heavy industry is notoriously reliant on massive debt loads to fund continuous equipment upgrades.
Yeah.
you know, and mine development.
Yeah, usually these companies are leveraged to the hilt.
But Shenhua holds a net cash position, and this is incorporating liquid assets and time deposits of roughly 55 to 65 billion RMB.
65 billion in net cash.
Yes. And their gearing ratio is an incredibly conservative 23.2%. They are completely insulated from interest rate shocks or credit market freezes.
Okay, but before we wonder if this cash machine is going to run out of raw material, the memo highlights that their reserves are actually expanding.
Yeah, that surprised me too.
They are sitting on 15.09 billion tons of recoverable reserves. Based on their current extraction rate, that implies an aggregate mine life north of 45 years.
Over four decades.
Yeah. But here is the operational detail that completely shifted my understanding of their logistics dominance.
Let's hear it.
The memo notes that Shenhua buys a massive amount of coal from third parties, about 132.3 million tons.
Right, the purchased coal.
Yeah, but they only realize a 1.8% gross margin on that purchased coal. So my question is, why would a company with 45 years of reserves and 47% margins on their own product bother buying over 130 million tons of a competitor's product just to break even?
Because they purchased that coal purely as logistics filler.
Logistics filler.
Yeah, it is a masterclass in asset utilization.
Yeah.
As we discussed, a railway line and a deep water port are massive fixed cost assets.
Right, you got to pay for them either way.
Exactly. So to generate those 37% and 39% margins, the volume moving through that infrastructure must remain at absolute maximum capacity every single hour of the day.
Oh, I see.
If Shenhua's internal mining operations cannot extract coal fast enough to fill every single train car on that 2,400 kilometer track,
yeah,
the fixed costs of the railway begin to eat into the margin.
Oh, it's like an airline running a completely empty flight just to maintain their lucrative gate slots at JFK.
That's a great way to think about it.
Except Shenhua literally fills the plane with the competitor's passengers, charges them almost nothing just to keep the engines warm and the gate secure. The margin isn't in the purchased coal at all. The margin is in the movement. They are just feeding the logistics beast.
Yep, feeding the beast. And, you know, the ultimate stress test for any cyclical asset in your portfolio is asking what happens to the balance sheet when the industry experiences a worst-case scenario.
Right.
Shenhua survives because its unit economics are physically and structurally decoupled from the rest of the market.
Okay, so we see that the cost floor is essentially titanium, but an investment thesis cannot survive on a low floor alone, right? We have to figure out what limits the upside.
Yep.
If the internal operations are a perfectly optimized machine, how does the external regulatory environment constrain them? Because we know there's a ceiling here.
There is, and this requires an understanding of the National Development and Reform Commission, or the NDRC.
Right, the state regulator.
In China, energy pricing is not left entirely to the whims of the open spot market. Following a severe energy crunch back in 2021, where skyrocketing global coal prices forced domestic power plants to operate at massive losses, leading to grid instability, the NDRC intervened.
They stepped in to stop the bleeding.
Yeah, they established a formalized, reasonable range for medium and long-term thermal coal contracts.
And that state-mandated price band is locked between 570 and 770 RMB per ton, right?
That's land.
And Shenhua has opted to tie a massive 87% of its total sales volume to these long-term contracts anchored to that specific band.
Which is huge. The effects of that lock-in are profound when you look at the volatility of the spot market.
Give us an example.
So between 2024 and 2025, global energy dynamics shifted, and the open market spot price of coal suffered a severe down cycle, plummeting from over 900 RMB down into the mid-600s.
A huge drop.
Huge. Yet, Shenhua's realized price, the actual average revenue they booked per ton, declined by a mere 3.4%.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. This price band is the ultimate double-edged sword for an investor.
Oh, for sure.
Because on the downside, the government is essentially handing you a sovereign insurance policy against insolvency. They're structurally preventing the core contract price from crashing below 570 RMB.
Yep, that's the floor.
But on the upside, it acts as a hard speed limit. If a geopolitical shock sends the spot price of coal to 1200 RMB tomorrow, Shenhua's upside capture is severely muted. You are mathematically forbidden from experiencing the euphoric peaks of a traditional commodity supercycle.
Yeah.
You can never go 100 miles per hour during a boom.
Right, but the state enforces this ban to balance two critical opposing economic pillars. Well, first, they must ensure that the downstream utility companies can acquire fuel at a predictable, affordable rate so that industrial production and civilian grids remain functional, you know, without bankrupting the utilities.
Keep the lights on, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But simultaneously, they need to protect the low-cost incumbent producers from being hollowed out during supply gluts. The result is the transformation of a highly volatile global commodity into a quasi-utility cash annuity.
Which is exactly what utility-starved dividend investors are hunting for right now.
Yep.
But the NDRC price band is only half the armor. There is a secondary internal mechanism they use to hedge their exposure, relying on that captive power generation segment we touched on earlier.
Right, the power plants.
Yeah, they control roughly 46.3 gigawatts of power capacity that burns their own internally sourced coal.
And that internal hedge functions automatically. When macroeconomic forces compress coal prices, the mining segment inevitably reports lower revenues and shrinking margins. However, those power plants are the primary consumers of that cheaper coal. So, dollar for dollar, as the mining segment loses revenue, the power segment's fuel expenditure drops, mechanically expanding the power segment's profit margin.
Wow, that's elegant.
Yeah. During the spot price drop in 2025, the memo details that Shenhe's power segment actually expanded its gross margin by approximately 3.5 percentage points.
So one segment of the fortress actively subsidizes the other, perfectly counterbalancing the external market weather.
Exactly.
Think about that for a second. When you evaluate the boring, stable assets in your own portfolio, you have to ask if they are consciously sacrificing those violent cyclical peaks in order to guarantee through-cycle predictability. Because that exact predictability is the engine behind massive, multi-year dividend payouts.
So true. And we have established the structural integrity of the fortress here. The logistics moat is irreplicable, the cash costs are the lowest in the world, the reserves span decades, and the regulatory environment provides a hard floor on earnings.
Sounds perfect. So what's the catch?
Well, to understand the analyst's caution, we must pivot to the glacier this fortress is built upon. We have to examine the macroeconomic reality of thermal coal and the resulting fractures appearing in Shenhe's cash flow statement.
Right, the melting glacier. And the secular decline is not a vague environmental concept here. It is a formalized state target. The Chinese government has committed to reaching peak coal consumption before 2030.
Yeah.
That is less than 4 years from the date of this memo.
And the broader energy transition mechanics are already taking market share. Forecasts dictate that renewable energy sources will surpass coal in the total generation mix, reaching roughly 49% by that same 2030 milestone.
So it's happening fast.
Very fast. We are no longer dealing with future projections. The physical reality of the shift is measurable today. In 2025, total coal power generation volume in China contracted by somewhere between 3.9% and 5.4%.
So the addressable pie is officially shrinking?
It is.
And that top-line macroeconomic decay is cascading directly onto Shenhe's income statement. The memo points out that their cyclical earnings peak occurred in fiscal year 2022 at 72.9 billion RMB.
Right.
By fiscal year 2025, net earnings had slid down to 54.2 billion RMB. We are looking at three consecutive years of top-level earnings erosion.
Yeah, that's a clear trend.
But the income statement isn't actually the primary concern of this analyst, is it? The critical tension is happening on the cash flow statement.
It really is. The trajectory of their capital expenditures reveals the true internal panic of a company facing terminal decline. Between 2021 and 2025, Shenhe's CapEx absolutely exploded.
How much?
It doubled from 23 billion RMB to 46.7 billion.
Wait. And the math of that doubling leads to a terrifying conclusion for a dividend investor. Because they dumped nearly $47 billion into CapEx, their free cash flow, you know, the actual liquid cash generated by the business after operating expenses and physical investments are paid for, that dropped to 28.4 billion RMB in 2025.
Right.
But the declared dividend paid out to shareholders that exact same year was 41.8 billion RMB.
Yes.
You're paying out substantially more than you bring in.
The free cash flow payout ratio has inverted. They are actively consuming their own balance sheet to fund the yield.
Wait, if you're paying out $41 billion but only generating $28 billion in free cash flow, you are literally digging into your savings account to pay your shareholders. How is that sustainable over a long time horizon? That is a huge red flag.
Oh, I totally agree. It's not sustainable long term. But they can sustain the illusion temporarily because of that massive 90 to 100 billion RMB liquid asset hoard we discussed earlier.
Right. They have the savings to drain for now.
Exactly. The state mandate governing their shareholder return policy recently elevated the dividend floor, requiring a minimum payout of 65% of net profit.
Okay.
But in practice, Shenhua is currently paying out between 77% and 79%. They are literally draining the reservoir to meet the state's demand for yield.
But if the underlying coal business is highly profitable and requires minimal maintenance capex relative to its cash generation, where exactly is that $46.7 billion going? Like, if the glacier is melting, why are you spending double the money?
Well, the capital allocation strategy betrays their pivot. They are not plowing that $46.7 billion back into expanding the high-margin coal mines or laying more high-return heavy-haul track.
Where is it going, then?
The single largest line item for CapEx in 2025 was 19.3 billion RMB, directed entirely into the power segment.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, they are furiously building out new regulated power capacity while simultaneously funneling capital into coal chemical facilities.
Which the memo explicitly flags as lower return adjacencies, right?
Exactly.
I mean, the gross margin on the coal chemical segment is a dismal 3.1%.
It's surrogate.
They are taking the pristine cash flows generated by the ultimate logistical monopoly and dumping them into low-margin, capital-intensive side quests.
It's because Shenhua has become an ex-growth cash cow. Management realizes the core business faces a terminal horizon, so they are desperately trying to construct a regulated power portfolio to act as a ballast for when the coal volumes permanently recede.
That makes sense strategically, but financially?
Financially, it's rough. The problem is that the return on invested capital for these new power projects pales in comparison to this historical returns of the legacy coal network.
And this dynamic is exactly why you cannot blindly trust a high dividend yield on a stock screener.
Absolutely not.
You see a 7.7% yield backed by a massive sovereign entity, and you assume it's a bulletproof bond proxy. But a yield is only as safe as the organic cash flow covering it.
Exactly.
If the free cash flow doesn't cover the distribution, you aren't receiving a return on your capital. You are just being handed your own capital back while the company's internal value deteriorates.
And that realization forces a critical examination of corporate governance. If management is willing to burn the balance sheet to pay an uncovered dividend while simultaneously funneling tens of billions into low-margin adjacencies, we have to ask, who exactly is sitting at the head of the table making these capital allocation decisions?
Which leads us directly to the controlling shareholder and the massive governance risks that minority investors are forced to accept. So who actually owns China Shenhua?
The ultimate controller is the state. Specifically, China Energy Investment Corporation, which is a central state-owned enterprise managed directly by SASAC, the State-Owned Asset Supervision and Administration Commission.
Okay.
They maintain an iron grip on the company, holding a 69.52% controlling majority stake.
And we have to evaluate the structural reality of this ownership block impartially here. State-owned enterprises operate under a fundamentally different set of incentives than Western publicly traded corporations.
Completely different.
The mandate of a SASAC enterprise is not strictly to maximize total shareholder return or aggressively compound per share value. Their mandate is to execute the macroeconomic and geopolitical priorities of the Chinese government.
Right.
And for a minority investor buying the ADR on the open market, that means your financial interests are, at best, a secondary consideration.
And the implications of that ownership structure materialized dramatically in late 2025 and early 2026. Shenhua announced a breathtaking related party transaction.
The elephant in the room.
Oh, yeah. They moved to acquire 12 to 13 separate enterprises spanning coal operations, power generation, chemical processing, and logistics directly from their own parent company, China Energy.
Wow. And what was the price tag on that?
The transaction value was a staggering 133 billion RMB.
Which is roughly equivalent to 18.9 billion US dollars.
Yeah.
So what does this all mean for a regular investor? I mean, you are flying blind on an almost $19 billion acquisition. When the deal was initially announced, the vital metrics that any Western analyst would demand, the exact multiple paid, the underlying valuation methodology of the assets, and crucially, whether the acquisition was actively accretive or dilutive to the earnings per share of the public entity, were simply not disclosed to the minority shareholders.
It really highlights a deep systemic entanglement. The memo provides a metric that quantifies this perfectly. 32.3% of Shenhua's entire revenue is intergroup.
Wait, really?
Yeah, they're generating a third of their sales by selling products right back to the parent company.
Oh, wow.
Furthermore, due to a complex web of regional joint ventures, approximately 16% of the overall group profit leaks out to various non-controlling minority interests before it ever reaches the bottom line for public shareholders.
So the parent company is the controlling owner, the executive management, and the largest customer all at the same time. If you are buying the public stock, it's like being a passenger in a car where the driver owns the destination, the gas station, and the toll booths. Are you going to get taken for a ride?
Well, the analyst zeroes in on this governance flashpoint. The 133 billion RMB transaction is funded heavily through the issuance of new A shares directly back to the parent company, further diluting the public float and entrenching the parent's control.
Right.
Capital allocation in this structure serves the state first.
Yeah.
Currently, there is an ongoing SOE revaluation drive dictated by the central government, which mandates that these enterprises increase their cash returns to the state.
Okay, so that's why they're pushing the dividends so high.
Exactly. It creates a temporary serendipitous alignment. The state needs cash, so they force Xinhua to pay out a massive dividend, which thrills the minority income investors.
But the danger lies in the permanence of that alignment. What happens when the macroeconomic priorities shift? If the central government decides that the parent company needs to clean up its balance sheet by dumping aging, heavily indebted, deeply unprofitable power assets, they can force Xinhua to acquire those assets at above market valuations.
And as a minority shareholder, you have absolutely zero veto power. You are entirely a price taker.
This is the invisible risk of investing in state-owned enterprises. The financials might look pristine, but the incentives of the controlling shareholder might not align with maximizing your per-share value. You must demand a massive risk premium to compensate for that governance opacity. The pristine financials and the logistical moat are essentially rented from the state. The ultimate destination of the cash flows will always be subordinated to national policy.
That's the variant perception right there, isn't it?
It really is.
Because when we take all of this into account, the unbreakable physical moat, the slow structural melt of thermal coal, the free cash flow cracking under the weight of CapEx, and an $18 billion related party transaction executed in the dark, how is the global market actually pricing this asset today?
Right, because the math seems to be moving in opposite directions. Earnings are dropping, but the price-to-earnings multiple is going up.
Yeah, the market has completely re-rated the stock over the last 12 months. Even as net earnings fell 25% off their 2022 highs, the enterprise value to EBITDA multiple, which, you know, values the entire capital structure of the business against its cash generation, that expanded from its historical five-year average of roughly 5x up to 7x.
Wow.
And the price-to-earnings ratio is currently hovering around 14 to 16x.
People are literally paying more for a smaller slice of a shrinking pie. Why? What exactly is the market seeing that overrides the declining cash flow and the governance risks?
Well, they are seeing a durable, policy-floored cash annuity in a world starved for yield. Global macroeconomic uncertainty and fluctuating interest rate environments have driven institutional capital to seek out defensive bond-like equities.
Ah, so they're just chasing the yield.
Exactly. The market looks at Xinhua, observes the NDRC price floor, sees the fortress balance sheet, notes the state-mandated 65% dividend payout floor, and decides to pay a massive safety premium. They are not pricing in the terminal decline of coal. They're pricing in the immediate certainty of the dividend.
But wait, if the multiple has expanded that aggressively, the traditional margin of safety for foreign investors must be completely wiped out.
It is.
Because usually institutional investors play the dual listing arbitrage. They look at the A shares listed in mainland China, which usually trade at a massive premium, and then they buy the A shares listed in Hong Kong, which historically trade at a 30 to 40% discount for state-owned enterprises.
Yeah, that classic buy the cheap H share arbitrage is dead. The massive influx of capital hunting for that nearly 8% yield has compressed the AH premium to an incredibly narrow 5 to 6%.
Wow.
The Hong Kong shares are fully priced. You are no longer buying the asset at a distressed valuation.
And if you're a retail investor sitting at home looking at your brokerage app, seeing that 7.7% yield on the CSUAY ticker, you have to factor in the friction of the ADR structure itself.
Well, definitely.
Because the over-the-counter market is brutally illiquid. I mean, the memo notes average daily volume is only around 14,500 shares. That means the bid-ask spread is going to eat into your principal the moment you execute the trade.
Right.
Then you face a mandatory 10% dividend withholding tax. And finally, you carry total exposure to RMB depreciation risk. If the Chinese currency weakens against the US dollar over the next 5 years, your dividend yield shrinks mechanically in real terms. By the time the currency fluctuates, the tax is skimmed, and the spread is crossed, is that 7.7% yield actually a 4% yield in reality?
And that accumulation of friction, combined with the multiple expansion, forms the core of the analyst's ultimate conclusion. The analyst concedes that the bullish investors are entirely correct regarding the underlying quality of the asset.
Right, the quality is there.
The logistics network is a monopoly, the cost basis is untouchable, and the balance sheet is pristine. But the burden of proof has entirely shifted to the bears on price, even if the bulls are right on quality.
So the stock is priced for absolute perfection in a fundamentally imperfect, structurally declining sector.
Precisely. To justify paying 7x EBITDA while free cash flow fails to cover the dividend, the market is assuming several fragile conditions hold forever.
Like what?
It assumes the NDRC will never lower the 570 RMB price band. It assumes the state will never cut the dividend to fund more power plants. It assumes the 133 billion RMB parent injection will not be value destructive to the public entity.
And if just one of those breaks?
If coal pierces the floor sustainably or the new chemical plants bleed cash, the entire valuation thesis collapses.
Yeah.
And that safety premium will evaporate overnight.
This entire deep dive has been a masterclass in separating a great business from a great stock price. You can find the most impenetrable, best-in-class asset on the planet, complete with a sovereign-backed moat and limitless reserves. But a best-in-class asset is no longer a bargain once global capital crowds into the trade and rewrites the multiple. The price you pay ultimately dictates your rate of return, regardless of how thick the fortress walls are.
It reinforces the eternal discipline of capital allocation. A brilliant company acquired at the wrong multiple inevitably becomes a terrible investment.
So let's synthesize this journey. We started by dissecting an unbelievable physical moat, a 2,400-kilometer captive heavy-haul logistics network operating at near 40% margins, subsidized by third-party coal, resulting in a bottom-tier extraction cost of 167 RMB per ton that guarantees survival in the darkest of commodity winters.
Right.
And we analyzed the state-mandated NDRC price band that acts simultaneously as an insolvency insurance policy and a cyclical speed limit.
Then we confronted the reality of the melting glacier, the irreversible, state-mandated decline of thermal coal demand heading into 2030, which has panicked management into doubling capital expenditures toward lower return power adjacencies, mechanically forcing the free cash flow to drop below the stated dividend payout.
And finally, we navigated the incredibly opaque realities of state-owned corporate governance, culminating in an $18.9 billion related party asset injection that minority shareholders are forced to swallow whole, surviving solely on the hope that the central government's desire for cash continues to align with their own demand for yield.
Which leaves us with a final puzzle, a scenario to stress test your own models long after this deep dive ends.
Let's hear it.
We have established that Shenhe's current dividend bonanza exists purely because the state regulator, the state majority owner, and the minority public investor are all currently aligned in wanting maximum cash extracted from the business today. But ask yourself, what happens to your valuation models the day those priorities inevitably diverge? What happens the day the state decides that maximizing domestic energy security requires Shenhe to operate its massive logistics network and mining operations at a deliberate loss in order to subsidize a struggling national grid?
Oh, wow.
How do you value an impenetrable moat when the sovereign entity that built it can legally order the drawbridge to be permanently lowered?
That is a chilling thought for anyone holding the stock for the yield alone, and a profound question about the true nature of investing in heavily regulated, state-controlled infrastructure. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep looking for those hidden logistics margins. Keep stress testing those free cash flow payout ratios against the stated dividend. And as always, keep questioning the consensus. We'll catch you next time.